Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival with debates on the key cultural, political and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Good morning, everybody. I'd really like to give you a warm welcome to this opening keynote of this morning's Battle of Ideas session. For those of you who weren't here yesterday, my name's Claire Fox and I'm the director of the Institute of Ideas. Something about the spirit of the festival is that this is absolutely no holds barred open discussion, and it seems appropriate to me to start off with one of the most important keynotes I think of this weekend, which is why young people joining ISIS. And I'm very happy to be having this discussion, but it's a tragedy that we need to, but that's the deal. This issue has been of particular interest and preoccupied me at least for some time. I think what's utterly fascinating about the topic is working out why young Europeans, people from the UK, are radicalised to go and join an organisation like ISIS. And I don't think there's a straightforward answer to that. But one thing I'm sure about is that there's something in the answer that's homegrown. It's not a straightforward thing. So there's a kind of presumption that there's something alien has come and taken these young people away, whereas what I think is fascinating is that there are many young people who are our peers and our colleagues and people we know who've been brought up in Europe, and they want to turn their back on Western civilization and go and join ISIS. So I think it's at least an important topic to get to grips with. The whole of the Battle of Ideas, in a way, is about winning a battle of ideas in this instance. It's interesting, isn't it? Because when the government declared that it wants to win a battle of ideas in order to win the hearts and minds of young people who are attracted to ISIS, they then immediately say, we're going to win a battle of ideas, we're going to ban anyone who says the wrong thing. So that's not quite where we're going on this. I think it's to the credit of the British Humanist Association. I'd like to absolutely thank them for sponsoring this session. The BHA and I often argue over many, many things, but they were prepared to be involved in and actively supportive of the importance of this session. I think it's to their credit. So before we start anything, can we just like give them, I mean, they're not here, but let's give them a round of applause and say thank you very much. So, in the spirit of the Battle of Ideas, we've got some very interesting people who are going to kick off the debate, but they're not here as experts in the sense that they're just going to share with us their thoughts, and then we're going to have an open and frank discussion with the audience. So, to introduce my panellists, absolutely delighted the first person who's going to speak in a moment is Professor Ted Cantle, CBE, Director of the Institute of Community Cohesion. He chaired the Community Cohesion Review of the riots in Northern Towns in 2001, and he came up with the term which I've been quoting ever since, of parallel lives. I've actually wanted to get Ted to speak at something for ages, so I'm thrilled. Can we give him a warm welcome, please? We're then going to hear from Professor Bill Derodier, who's over there. He's Head of Department and Chair of International Relations at the University of Bath. Back in the UK, after high-profile senior roles in Singapore and Canada, he speaks all around the world, in fact, on issues associated with fear and terrorism and risk. He's Associate Fellow at Chatham House, a battle regular. We're delighted to have him. He's cheaper this year because he's only come from Bath, but we're delighted to have him back. Can we give him a warm welcome, please? Shiraz Mahat we'll be hearing from then. I feel as though I've possibly been stalking him. It's partly because I follow him on Twitter, but you know, like when you follow someone on Twitter and you think they're really interesting and you retweet them. I'm one of those people. Don't worry, I'm all right. He's absolutely fantastically interesting on all of these discussions. He's a Senior Research Fellow and Head of Outreach at the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation at King's College London. Obviously, perfectly place to talk about this. He coordinates a centre research on Syrian, on the Syrian and Iraqi conflicts and the development of the Salafi jihadi ideology. As I say, I've long been an admirer. I'm delighted to have him here. Give him a warm welcome. Sadly, one of our speakers had a bereavement in the family yesterday, Kalsoum Bashir. So we've asked, in fact, Rania Havas to take her place. She's not politically taking her place, but Rania actually spoke on this very topic at Wellington Festival and is also on the panel later today on British values, so we knew that she'd be thinking in this area. Rania is a senior lecturer in education and community studies at the University of Greenwich, founder of Muslim Women in Education. When she spoke at Greenwich, she was one of the people who gave everybody in the audience and on the panel most pause to think, and she speaks her mind, does this woman. Can we give her a warm welcome? And I'm going to introduce a fifth panellist who's not here but is on his way. Mohsin Oja, who's the principal of Crest Academies and has been since the start of this year. Mohsin is head of a school that serves a community where over 80% of the students speak English as an additional language, and the proportion of students from minority ethnic groups is much higher than the national average. He is on the front line of this discussion. I was just telling Ted, I spoke at the school on free speech after Charlie Hebdo, and it was challenging, to say the least. And they didn't agree with me at all. And I think that most of them, actually, that they organised that debate at all and got me in was a testament to the kind of work that he's trying to do. But there are real frontline challenges, and it'll be very interesting when he arrives to hear what they are. So that's our panel. Ted, kick us off. You've only, sadly, got 5 to 7 minutes, but do what you can with that.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Firstly, I think my starting point is there is no single reason why young people join ISIS. There's no single definition of young, incidentally. Whilst we know that younger people are being pulled towards extremism, actually a significant proportion are in their late 20s and in their 30s. We need to bear that in mind. There is no one profile out there. We have had a problem in this country, I believe, with the prevent agenda because of the way it's characterised the debate since its inception in 2007. It started off on the basis of the conveyor belt theory of radicalisation, and therefore that really that was the single issue involved in this process. And even the new guidance issued this year focuses very much on that issue. It really assumed that people were being groomed and indoctrinated through theological ideas. Prevent has a number of other problems. It focused entirely on the Muslim community, and I think we've got to broaden out the debate to recognise that this is about young people more generally coming to terms with diversity and globalisation. But it did result in the Muslim community becoming a suspect community, literally put under surveillance, and of course the counter-terrorism legislation more recently means that tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of public servants are being trained to actually identify potential terrorists, and it will be principally amongst the Muslim community, which means the Muslim community has become more alienated and the way it's perceived by others has become more prejudicial. I accept that Prevent has improved a little over the years, taking in far-right extremists, for example, but obviously we just don't know how successful that programme is. There's very little information produced about either Prevent or about the Channel project. So why do young people join ISIS? Well, I want to suggest about eight interwoven reasons. The first, obviously, is that there is some religious indoctrination or narrative that pulls people towards it. Of course, that is the case. But for others, it's completely the opposite. Little or no knowledge of Islam, as Mark Sageman pointed out, that the majority of terrorists that he had analysed had come to their religious beliefs through self-instruction. Their religious understanding was very limited. They know as much about religion as a secular person, which is to say very little. Their ideas tend to be an incoherent mishmash of disparate ideologies. And there's some evidence, he said, that actually a strong religious upbringing upbringing can actually help to inoculate young Muslims against terrorism. So I think we've got to bear that in mind. Actually, a lot of the identified terrorists were people who were the newest members of their religion. Thirdly, I think we've got to accept that there are some who are just thrill seekers, wannabes. The Kalashnikov and the grenade sounds pretty attractive to some people. Fourthly, and very much related to that, there are people that want to try and escape a restricted environment, a misguided bid for freedom. I wanted a little quote just to sum that up was, they want to find something meaningful for their life. Some are thrill seeking, some are seeking redemption. Fifthly, I think we have to accept that some people have complex mental health problems. Again, that's been shown to be the case in a number of prominent cases itself. Sixthly, I think we have to accept that a lot of young people are struggling with their personal and collective identity. And if I can quote a fellow member of the panel, she is here. ISIS offers an identity that transcends culture. It says, here's an intellectual identity. You're Muslim. ISIS knows exactly what it stands for and is confident urging others to become better Muslims and to join it. Points out that the problem of identity is even more difficult for Muslim women. Now, if you delete Muslim from that particular quote, actually that could refer to quite a number of young people coming to terms with globalisation and diversity. We also have to accept that some people are politically rather than theologically driven, my sort of seventh argument. This notion of the war on Islam, which has been a constant part of dialogue for the last 15 years or so, and we have to accept that that is very much part of the dialogue that's out there. I don't think we take this sufficiently seriously enough, and in fact we've often refused to engage with it. It's been very difficult for community organisations and others to get a speaker from, I don't know, the Foreign Office or from government or from any part of government to come and actually debate those sorts of contentious issues and to get them out in the open and give people a chance to challenge their understanding. To quote an American commentator, the fact of the matter is that when we're not going to respond to accusations of unethical foreign policy, to effects of the drones, to sanctions, to the war on terror, when we're not going to talk about the impact that these foreign policies have on thousands and hundreds of thousands of people, the only people that are actually talking about the impact are the radicals. I think we also have to accept, and very much related to that, my sort of eighth point really, that this focus, sole focus on the Muslim community, completely misses the point that there is a much more general issue about how young people develop critical thinking skills, develop the ability to challenge the narrative from their communities, from their parents, and particularly in highly segregated and partial environments, whether that's in residential terms or in school terms. How do they actually begin to find out other perspectives and use those other perspectives to challenge their understanding and the understanding which is being given to them? The fact is, I think Claire alluded to this in her introduction, there is very limited debate of contentious issues. And how have we responded to that? By banning extremists in universities, for example. It's as though undergraduates and postgraduates haven't actually got the critical thinking skills themselves to sort out those sorts of ideas, which is a very sad reflection of on our education system if by the time people have reached that age they are unable to distinguish right from wrong or good ideas from bad ideas. Just really related to that point, I would say that young people, particularly those growing up in a school environment, often have very little religious literacy, very little cultural understanding. Intercultural education is very poor. So I would probably want to turn the argument around and start at that end of the spectrum and say we shouldn't really be focusing so much on why people have reached that stage. We should be getting into a much earlier stage of debate and developing critical thinking skills so that people really are able to challenge all of the narratives for themselves.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ted. That was really a great overview and really gave us, I think, a platform on which we can have this discussion. Very useful. Bill?
Well, I'm going to try and introduce a slightly different dimension to the discussion, which I think, in a way, Ted has implied throughout, but not fully teased out. So I want you to cast your mind back to April of this year. It's the middle of April. There's a British general election going on. And on one of his campaign trips, the shadow education minister, Tristram Hunt, decides to do a photo opportunity at a school in Northamptonshire. And during the session, he sits down next to a small child and says to him, "If you could vote, who would you vote for?" And the little boy looks at him and goes, UKIP. And Tristram Hunt, who just 3 months earlier had written a piece in The Independent called "Why the United Kingdom Must Confront Rather Than Ignore UKIP," says, "Oh, very good. Why is that?" And the boy says, "Because they kick all the foreigners out." And Tristram Hunt says, "I see." And he walks off. Now, I don't know about you, but that was his opportunity to flesh out what he wrote abstractly and to make a few points about the benefits of immigration or whatever it is that he believes. And I give you that vignette not because it's got anything to do with terrorism, but because I am firmly convinced that one of the single biggest drivers is a moral abdication of responsibility on the part of those who are held to believe in something. That we live in a world where the authorities and the institutions who we presume to come with a certain particular outlook are no longer able to argue for that outlook, and no longer, in certain instances, really understand why they believe what they believe in the first place. Let me give you a couple of other examples. There's a growing number of publications now that look at how school teachers are reluctant to teach issues such as the Holocaust in the classroom. And the reason for that, in certain areas, is because there's a perception that particularly children who are presumed to be from predominantly Muslim backgrounds will say either that they don't believe in the Holocaust, or even in France, there's been instances of the children starting to laugh and just making crude jokes about it. And again, what we have is an instance of an inability of a culture to present what it believes to be true for fear that it might be counterproductive, for fear that it might be discomforting for certain students, that it might challenge the firm beliefs of certain students, and that it might actually draw them into being further anti-Semitic. My third example in the same vein is a chap called Avinash Tharoor. Avinash Tharoor was at the University of Westminster at the same time as Mohamed Imwazi, who's better known to most of us as Jihadi John. And Avinash Tharoor wrote a piece in the Washington Post on the 27th of February this year where he talks about his being in a class on international relations at the University of Westminster where the lecturer was talking about Kant's democratic peace theorem. And during the class, a young woman wearing a niqab stands up and says, "Well, as a Muslim, I don't believe in democracy." And Tharoor makes the point that these kind of comments were fairly common at the University of Westminster. What was actually shocking was the reluctance of the lecturer to engage with the answer. You know, it didn't say, "Well, maybe democracy is good for women, or maybe it's good for Muslims, or let's try and work out what we actually mean by democracy." And again, presumably for fear of causing offence, or even just self-confusion, not knowing what the lecturer actually, you know, thinks about what he's supposed to be presenting, there's no attempt to engage. Now, I don't know about you, but I think young people today are no different to young people pretty much in any age or any society. They are precocious, they are hungry for knowledge, they're energetic, wanting to seize the initiative, and above all, they want to find something to belong to and to believe in. And what they see when they look around them are individuals and institutions who no longer are able to articulate why it is that they believe in what they're held to believe in the first place. They look around, they see people with no principles. There's nothing for them to engage with. They're actually kicking down an open door. And we could describe that as a form of moral and cultural capitulation. But the driver isn't the young people, it's the evacuation of belief amongst those who should believe in something. Worse, we indulge the young people. We say that we understand their sense of grievance. We presume the reasons for that grievance for them. We say it's to do with maybe our foreign policy or race relations or religion, or we make up all sorts of other excuses. David Cameron is launching his counter-extremism initiative tomorrow morning. He wants to ban extremism and support for extremism, and we've already heard about the prevent duty. But I don't know anybody in government who really believes that you can legislate out terrorism. In other words, what you have now is a government that is putting in new laws, the seventh set of counter-terrorism laws since 9/11, pretty much one every other year, not because they know it will be effective, but in order to be seen to be doing something about terrorism. And I work in a university amongst 137 other universities in this country who will comply with the prevent duty, not because we believe that it is correct and it will be effective. On the contrary, many of the academics there think that it's completely misguided and it can't possibly work. But they know who pays their fees and salaries, and so they will follow up their prevent duty in order to be seen to be compliant with government legislation. Now, when you have a government and its dominant social institutions acting not out of firm belief but in order to be seen to be doing something, in my opinion, what you now live in is a society of bad faith. A society where people say what they don't believe and do things in order to be seen to be appearing to believe in things that they don't believe. And to the point where, with Tristram Hunt, they no longer even, it's not evident that they know how to defend what it is that they believe in the first place. And the consequence of living in a society of bad faith is that the idiotic rantings of Islamic State appear almost principled in comparison to what our young people are being provided with in the United Kingdom today. It's not so much that they're radicalized, it's that they are estranged from the society that they live in and alienated from it because we are failing to provide them with structure, rules, meaning, and purpose for their lives. And Ted mentioned the search for meaning, and I concur wholeheartedly with that. I don't think, in closing, that we should necessarily are able to learn anything from the young people who supposedly become radicalized themselves. The people at the sharp end, and maybe Shiraz will disagree because he actually studies those, I don't think always know what it is that propels them to doing what they do. You know, if we believe people's explanations for things, we'd have to believe it when the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, said that he murdered prostitutes because God told him to. But fortunately, we lived in a slightly more robust society that didn't believe that the Bible was actually instructing him to do that. David Cameron will argue that we need a counter-narrative against Islamism. My argument is we simply need a narrative of our own. We live in a society that no longer knows what it is that it believes in, and the consequence of that is that any idiot who believes in a half-baked idea is actually quite powerful in comparison. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Some serious provocations there, and certainly plenty for us to discuss and argue over afterwards. Welcome, Motion. I've already introduced you in your absence, so I'll wait. You can speak last once we've got through everything else, but we're delighted you're here. Shiraz.
Thank you. I could limit my comments just to six words, what Ted said, what Bill said. I will reinforce what they've said and try to go slightly more into the sort of micro picture of the individuals who have gone out to Syria and Iraq, 100 of whom from across Europe I've been able to interview, and that's given me some insights into the sorts of reasons that they're suggesting for why they've gone. But I think ultimately Let's start with the issue of religion, that there is a sort of ideological nature to this. I think that is overstated in many cases. Religion clearly plays a role, but it only plays a role in some instances. And as you've heard from the other two panelists thus far, in many cases, these guys actually tend to be religious novices. They don't have a particularly sophisticated understanding or knowledge of what it is that they're doing. And to really sort of further that, you know, people often ask me, well, why do these jihadis talk to you? And one of the interesting things that I've found in the course of sort of trying to convince them to speak to me is that I've written a book on Salafi jihadism. I've read all the stuff that they're supposed to believe in, and they don't know it. They haven't read the stuff. They haven't really encountered literature. When you talk to them about some of the most important scholars in their own world, like Maqdisi, like Abu Qatada, these are individuals who are deeply opposed to ISIS, to Islamic State. And yet, you know, they've obviously gone off and joined that group. So there's a sense of inconsistency with what they're doing and a real lack of knowledge. The reality is, as you've heard, again, already said, is that we don't really know what it is we stand for. So we don't have anything to offer people to buy into. There's nothing here that you can say to people, be part of this. By contrast, Islamic State is self-assured. It's very certain about what it stands for. It offers a very powerful and seductive thing to people. So as people are getting increasingly confused about hyphenated identities, am I British Muslim? Am I British Pakistani? Am I this? Am I that? Islamic State says we can transcend all of that. We offer you an identity. We offer you a vision. We offer you something that's not grounded in geography. We offer you an ideological and an intellectual identity. You're a Muslim. You're a part of the Ummah. You're part of this global fraternity of the faithful of 1.5 billion people. And that's very, very powerful. It's very seductive. And as I say, it's self-assured in this time when other things are not quite so self-assured. So I have a typology of, I'd say, five different types of people who go to Syria and Iraq, and different sort of categories, you could say, have been more important at different times. At the start of the conflict, when I began interviewing people, when I started to put a lot of this data together, 2012 and 2013, you had this sense that people were going out there for genuinely humanitarian reasons. They compared themselves to individuals who fought in the Spanish Civil War. They had a sense that the Syrian people had been betrayed by the world, that they'd been surrendered to the Ba'athist regime, and someone had to come and help them. Someone had to come and defend them. And so they wanted to go, and they wanted to be part of this. And it's worth pointing out that those individuals in those early stages, they did not see what they were doing as being legally contentious or indeed morally contentious. There was a real sense of certainty, and they were genuinely confused. Why is Theresa May calling me a terrorist? Because they felt that what they were doing was the right thing, and they felt what they were doing had the weight of history on its side, and indeed was broadly in line with our own foreign policy. So, as I say, there was a point of confusion there. It's also worth saying, in relation to that, we spoke a lot in 2003 and 4 and 5 and subsequently about this idea of a radicalization of commission. Because we went into Iraq, we radicalized XYZ number of people in particular ways. But you can make the exact same case now in Syria, particularly in those early phases where there was a radicalization by omission. Because we were not helping, because we were not on the ground, because we weren't supporting these people, individuals who had gone out there and elected to fight this battle were saying, we had to take this into our own hands. So it's just worth considering the way the narrative shifts from time to time. Amongst some of the more religious people, this brings me on to the second category of my typology, there are people who have a slightly more religious sense, and they believe strongly in two complementary ideas. The first is the virtues of jihad, and the second builds on that, which is the virtues of martyrdom. For them, this is the shortcut to paradise. They want to die as soon as they arrive in Syria and Iraq, because they believe that they will be sent straight to heaven. And to that extent, you've seen already seven British suicide bombers in this conflict, in addition to a number of others from across Europe. So they have a real conviction there, and they believe very strongly in those ideas. The third category, you could say, is sort of the least contentious, is long-standing radicals. And I always sort of describe this as people in the sort of Anjem Chowdhury network. These are individuals who have had a long-standing history of radical activism. They, for whatever reason, have chosen to pit themselves against our society and indeed against Western civilization. This is the fight they've wanted to have. Here's the opportunity, and off they go. Slightly linked to that, you have a number of individuals who believe in the idea of the caliphate very, very strongly. And that once the Khilafah has been declared, once it's arrived, it is no longer permissible for you to live in the West. Doesn't matter how sort of, I suppose, bad the state might be, whatever its problems might be, once the Khilafah is there, you must go and support it. You must be part of it. And to that extent, this is why you've seen families go, entire generations of different families who have up sticks and moved there because they are very strongly motivated by that idea. The final category, which again we don't talk enough about but is very important, is former criminals, adventure seekers, guys for whom this appeals to their sense of masculinity. And in essence, these guys really are the idiots who have gone out there just to have a ruck. You've seen a big cluster of guys from East London who I would put in this category. There's a group which produced a lot of propaganda. It doesn't do so much anymore because most of its members are dead, called Rayat Tawheed. It means the flag of unity. And these individuals really were from an East London gang who principally sold drugs before they all went out to Syria. And they're really motivated by this sense of, you know, we used to talk about having guns and being bad boys in East London, but now we can do it. And that replays into a lot of what motivates them. I'll end by just saying one comment on the women. The narrative about women in the press is patronizing and wrong. The suggestion that women are jihadi brides is nonsense. The women have agency. The women are, in my opinion, far more ideologically motivated, much clearer about what it is that they're going to join and what it is that they're going to be part of. And in that sense, they are perhaps slightly more informed political agents than the men.
Thanks so much. I think that really helped build on some of the earlier contributions, and I think does give us quite a range of things that we can look at in terms of the different drivers. Rania, your thoughts?
So the question is, why are young people joining ISIS? And the underlying ideas we're talking about, terms we've already heard, are things like extremism and radicalization. And my issue is, we haven't really still defined, I know we've gone a long way towards discussing what they might be, but we still haven't defined that. And my worry is that, and Ted alluded to it, that in doing this, we are pathologizing what it is to be a Muslim and Islam. Shiraz mentioned the concept of the Ummah. I believe in that concept. Doesn't mean I'm about to go off to and kill some people in Syria, and I actually have family in Syria. So there are some concepts that are, and I remember Tony Blair years ago saying how bad it is that Muslims believe in the Ummah, and that was a long time ago. And I remember feeling very, very aggrieved and alarmed because I thought, well, I believe in the Ummah. And I know this is not the forum to discuss what Ummah means, but what I'm trying to say is there are lots of Islamic concepts that a lot of Muslims adhere to, believe to, and there are principles behind them and history and a philosophy, and yet these are being now bandied about as if they are something kind of one of the stages on that. The word was it the conveyor belt towards extremism? And I want to give you a little anecdote. I teach at university, and this year, my second year cohort walked in. This was a degree in education and community studies. And I was welcoming them in, and I noticed one of the young lads from last year. He happens to be an Asian Muslim guy, young man. And I noticed that his beard looked a little bit bushier this year. And I found myself thinking, now, is this a hipster beard or is this a sign of radicalization? And I seriously was thinking that. And that kind of concerned me a little bit. Again, this morning, I was getting ready. I was here yesterday, and I have a long day because I wasn't meant to be on the 10 a.m. one, and then I had to step in. And I thought, 10 a.m. debate, 5:30 debate, what shall I wear? And there was a suit, a black trousers, a jacket, and something that would look very European. And there was the abaya, which, tell you the truth, is actually very comfortable and hides a multitude of sins. And it means I can be very comfortable all day. And I thought to myself, but what would people think? And this is, again, it's I know it sounds like trivializing it, but it is interesting that there are lots of things that Muslims do, they do here, and we are problematizing them, and we are not really talking about, okay, what does it mean to be radical? Is it to do with wearing the niqab? Because the young woman who wore the niqab said she doesn't believe in democracy, is she a potential radical? There might be another 12 women who wore niqab and completely are paid up to the idea of democracy. But although I agree with Bill that what the lecturer should have done is say, why not? What is the issue? Democracy is problematic. Let's talk about it. That's what I would have done. So that's one of the ideas I'd like us to talk about. Actually, what does it mean to be radical? What does it mean to be extremist? Is there a way on that pathway? The other thing is a little bit about, should we really be worried about it? I wanted to look at the figures, and I think probably Shiraz, I was looking at some of the stuff that ICSR had published. And actually, in terms of Britain, the figures are still quite low. We're talking from 2011, according to the MOD, between 500 and 600 Brits went off to Syria. That was before the emergence of ISIS as the monster we see now. So obviously, there were a variety of reasons why this... small number. I wouldn't say it's a very tiny number or a large number, but actually a reasonable number. Again, my colleagues have already spoken about the reasons various people might have gone to Syria. I speak as someone who has family in Syria. I'm also Lebanese. And I know that certainly my brother, who calls himself a secular atheist, Muslim, Sunni, which is quite confusing, actually was, and he's a journalist, was very aggrieved about Syria. He didn't want to go off and literally fight. He wanted to work as a journalist to talk about what was happening in terms of the Ba'athi regime. He had a slightly different view of it. So, again, there were issues about Syria in particular as a conflict. And another point regarding ISIS that, and this is putting my Arab kind of hat on. A year ago, I was in Lebanon, and only 40 minutes drive from where I was, ISIS had already infiltrated that they'd come in, because there are a lot of Lebanese who've joined ISIS, and they were holding army personnel hostage, and they were killing them, regardless of their faith. They were literally killing them one after the other. And I was talking to various people in Lebanon who... were actually concerned, but at the same time, what they were concerned about, they knew that it wasn't going to spread. They kind of understood the politics of where would keep ISIS there. But they actually also were worried about certain members of our family who might be attracted by the idea of the sectarian, because of the sectarian divide. So I think what I'm trying to say is the origins of ISIS and the origins of the politics of the Middle East are far more complex and actually are far more dangerous. And just reducing ISIS to how we are reacting to it, or how maybe 500 of our British citizens have reacted to it, misses the point of the danger that the politics of the region poses to us. And back to the Western intervention, it's really interesting that some of the young people who went there, or the people who went there, they were influenced by the idea of the West intervening to fix it. And when they saw that it wasn't intervening, they thought they would take matters in their own hands. But the fact is, even when we're not intervening with arms and with bombing, which currently we are, at least in Iraq, and with drones in Syria, we have been intervening to prop up the kind of narrative that has created ISIS, and maybe Shiraz will talk a little bit more about that. Just the last point on this I can see is, my worry here is that we might be repeating what this song says, "You're so vain, I bet you think this song is about you." I think we need to widen the discussion a bit more. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Rania. Again, a few challenges to the narrative there that would be really useful to discuss. But Motion, welcome, and your thoughts, please.
Thank you. Well, I can only give my perspective as an educator, really, because we're in contact with young people, and by definition, they're at risk of becoming radicalised. To be honest, why do they join ISIS? I don't know. But my experience is that young people join groups because they don't have a sense of identity. And for me, it's no dissimilar for them joining a gang. And I've worked in London for some years. And it's about the same issues and ideas that would attract vulnerable young people to join syndicates that would offer them some sense of identity and security as well. But I think for young Muslims as well, it's also a problem. You know, whenever young people, you know, become embroiled and involved in anything remotely connected to radicalization, it's always about, well, what did the school do? You know, what could the school have done? What did the teachers do? Were they vigilant? And I totally agree with Bill's statement about this whole idea of prevent. We spend a significant amount of time with young people, so we should be able to identify the you know, the signs. But we're not well trained at it. And, you know, there's this incident that happened in North London where a young Muslim, perfectly sensible from a very, you know, well-aligned and middle-class family in North London, because he used the word eco-terrorist in his French debate, he was reported to the child protection officer, and he was frog-marching to this office and told, "Are you a terrorist?" Now, I can empathise with the family, I can empathise with the young man. Would he have been asked the same question if he was white and not Asian and not Muslim? And I think that that's something that's very sensitive, and we, you know, we obviously have to be very, very aware of that. It's also about how do young people perceive ISIS? What is it? And I think, you know, the point that was made about, it's basically a bunch of criminals. And I have absolutely no problem in identifying that and saying it to our students. I had a comedian who came to visit because she was doing some research. Obviously, the school has gone through, you know, it's got some history, and I'll talk about that a little bit more, about how it's just self-inflicted pain from the community and the leadership that would cause people to believe that because you're Muslim, you're likely to become radicalized. And she asked me the question. She said, you know, how do young people see these people? I said, they see them as idiots. No, there's no other way of putting it like that, because when I explain to them, I happen to be Muslim, so I have the ability. And I think Bill's point about I don't have to indulge to parents and students about their sensitivities. I'm well read, I understand the concept of Islam, but it is well within the you know, the points about tolerance and respect of each other. But at times it feels like some of my colleagues would be finding it very difficult to challenge any ideas that young people would have about religion. And Claire came to speak to some of our sixth formers on the back of the Charlie Hebdo murders, and it was very, very heated. And it does take some courage to actually challenge those misconceptions. And what happens is that when you go past that line, young people, by and large, in Britain, are open to debate. And I think we mustn't be scared to challenge them. And I think I'll take it back to our story. We have the academy is a little bit, it's in Brent, so we have 95% of students who are Muslim, but it was the boys and the girls school that were merged together, and the leadership before I arrived stopped short of merging the teaching. So they merged the schools, it was in one building, and as it happened, the boys and the girls were taught separately. When I asked why that was, they said that's what the parents want. But actually, that was misreading what the parents wanted, because all the parents wanted was a good education. But because standards were below expectations, what happened is that they maintained the segregation. So when you walked into the school, it was really uncomfortable. And you could see why any visitor from the DfE to Her Majesty's inspectors would come in and say, "What's going on here? What is the school doing about preventing this from, you know, preventing these young people and enabling them to contribute to the wider democratic debate, and, you know, how do they work together?" So in June, May and June, I made a decision to end the segregation of genders. And for me, the justification for that was very simple. It just didn't work. And when I put that to the parents, understandably, a lot of them said, "Why would you do that?" And it was a misconception amongst the parents that the school was a Muslim school. But it wasn't. The school was a secular school, mixed school, registered in the DfE. And it was very clear for me that it was that lack of communication, that lack of willingness to challenge misconceptions, to challenge local perceptions, and not indulge. They don't want you to indulge because they don't know what's good for them. We're the professionals, and we have a moral duty to respond and to teach our young people as best as we can. And I would say, yeah, first contact was difficult. It ranged from who are you to we don't want, you know, mixing is not good. This is a very good Muslim school. To other people say, well, how do you know that you're going to sort it out? And the fact remains that, you know, it's the elephant in the room. It did not work, so we had to do something about it. We lost about 20 to 30 students out of 1,300, and I was very, very clear with parents. Said, you have the most powerful tool in your box. It's parental choice. This is how we do things at Crest. And I think it's going back to what Bill was saying. If we're not very clear about what our values are, now we're very clear about what our values are in our school, I'm very confident that my students know exactly what's in it for them when they step into the academy. There's a sense of identity that wasn't there before, and there's a sense of tolerance that wasn't there before. It's okay for them to have their ideas challenged, but it's also okay for them to recognise themselves amongst, you know, I've been very lucky because we have... Our staff is very representative of the local community. And I think that's also a very important point. And I speak to colleagues, you know, who are in the same position as me. And a lot of them say to me, I don't think I'd be able to challenge parents the way you do. I don't think I'd be able to address the sensitive idea of Islam and radicalization the way you do. But I just think it's about, if you're determined and committed to make a difference in the communities and to prevent young people from joining criminal gangs, and I'm very clear about it, they're just a bunch of criminals, then it's our moral duty to do something about it.
Thank you very much indeed. So actually, I'm going to go straight out to the audience in the spirit of what Mohsin said, but also because a couple of things that happened yesterday. This is can be considered to be a tricky and sensitive issue to discuss. And yesterday, when we were having a debate about autistic freedom, I could see a certain tension, which is somebody said something, and I could see that one of the panel immediately wanted to go, you know, Islamophobia. I mean, if you see what I mean. So what I want to say is, say what you want. This panel will cope. We're not here to call names at each other. We're trying to work out what's going on. If you say something that's stupid, that's fine, and we might tell you that. But that's not the point. The point I'm trying to say is that I don't want people to walk on eggshells in this discussion, because I actually don't think we quite all understand it, right? I mean, it's like something we're all, I think, brilliant contributions from the front, but we're all trying to grasp at what we can do. And I think Mohsin was just saying, sometimes you just have to, you know, take the bull by a horn and kind of go forth and kind of do what you believe. So I just want to encourage that atmosphere in the discussion. Right.
I thought these were all very brilliant speeches. Thank you. The thing that gets me is that we have this problem in different European countries. So I don't come from Britain, but I come from Germany, and we also have thousands of young people joining ISIS. And yet the policies of the different European countries were very, very different. So in Germany, for example, we've always had a very strict separation, at least until the year 2000, between immigrants and Germans, the native population. And you would think there was a real reason, perhaps, for grievances of Muslims living in Germany. But in England, it was very different. So when I first came to England, I was surprised to see the extent of multiculturalism in this country. And I was almost like shocked to have somebody with a turban checking my passport, which would never have been possible in Germany. So I thought this country was paradise in terms of integration, and yet you have the same problem here. So how does this kind of fit together? You know, how does it's, you know, and things Rani was saying, I would think people here are so well integrated, and yet you have perhaps even a bigger problem of young people joining ISIS.
I would add to Ted's list of reasons. I want to talk about the policies and ideology of multiculturalism. And principally, I'm talking about identity politics, because I worked in Bethnal Green schools for 20 years up to about 10 years ago. And over that time, I noticed that it was impossible not to notice that pupils who had previously, maybe decades earlier, would have described themselves as Bangladeshi pupils were now calling themselves Muslims. And girls were wearing the hijab or the niqab in a way that their mothers never had. And And the identity that they were adopting was very much the identity of victim. It started to develop very much as though it was a badge of identity and victimhood. So also over that time, and it's hard not to make the connection because I was involved in this work in schools back then, there was a wave of school workshops on identity, on racism, on race, on Islamophobia, often, by the way, under the banner of community cohesion. But it was the same old thing. It was the rollout of a kind of identity politics facilitated into schools. No challenge, as Bill put it, to the ideas that were being presented in these workshops. I mean, I've got hundreds and hundreds of hours of footage of this stuff. And in the end, I just couldn't do it anymore. I had to stop and write about it. But so my final thought on it is when the Bethnal Green Girls absconded last year to Syria, it wasn't online Islamists that had cultivated their sense of victimhood and estrangement. Multiculturalism and that sort of corrosive logic of identity politics at its heart, that's what had cultivated their kind of whole mindset. Thank you.
Thank you. I have two short questions. It was proven that poverty is not a root cause for radicalization. However, dissatisfaction, meaning the gap between what you think you deserve and what you truly have, is a very strong root cause. Is there a way to cope with this subjective feeling? The second question is, do you think that the people who already went possess a threat to Britain's national security, and on the spectrum of ignoring them, cancel their citizenship and passport, and embracing them back, where are you standing in this spectrum?
I recently listened to this talk by ex-UK national chess champion, and he gave this talk on love, life, spirituality, and soul. And he was saying, one of the things that he's obviously really smart. He studied spirituality, philosophy, the rest of it. And one of the things that gave him the most satisfaction is being part of the Yes campaign for Scotland. I mean, we can debate separately whether that was a great thing or not. But what I'm trying to say is, before we think about whether it's ISIS or a different group, we need to look at the emotional drivers that pulls people in to join any groups. And if I were to look at, on the side of the pacifist, the weaknesses of pacifists is, look at us. We over-theorize and we over-analyze. We use big academic words. It's a bit daunting and boring. And if you look at, some of the other people, let's not forget about, the charisma, the sort of being able to strike emotional resonance, set the blood boiling, those strong passions. We need some more of that, I'm more thinking of alternative solutions. Do we need to bring in someone very charismatic who can operate on the same wavelength? In other words, they talk the same language to these youngsters that are joining these, ISIS groups. Maybe a rapper, somebody that beef up the coolness a little bit. Right. We need some like that. We need someone like that to really make it cooler than the other side.
Right.
Thank you.
Next year's Battle of Ideas, no panellists, rappers. Rappers and charismatic passion stirrers. You lot failed, obviously. Hopeless. Right, yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a point. I'm not sure about... A couple of people expressed the view that, in some sense, these young people were unsophisticated or untutored. That's not my reading. Maybe some are, but my understanding of the girls from Bethnal Green School is that they were straight-A students. And they were quite astute and aware of what the message was. But the message itself, the Wahhabi message, its power is its literalism. Its power is that it actually says more about the truth of the book than does the moderate view of Islam, which involves a bit of cherry-picking. So it's not the only religion that starts with a kind of blood-spattered account of its origins. Judaism, for example. The difference with Judaism is that it's been through a reformation. So my question to the panel is it not perhaps time for a Muslim reformation?
So, plenty to get stuck into there. A couple of observations, I suppose, that I'd like maybe some reflections on, because I've done quite a lot of talks at Islamic societies, at universities and so on. And the foreign policy point, which fascinates me, is I don't know anything about foreign politics either, right? So it's like sort of like I'd be getting a lecture on, you know, the politics of the Middle East, and I say something, and then they think, oh, you don't know what happened then, do you? You don't know what you're talking about. So it's a kind of sense of grievance about the politics of the Middle East that's absolutely not informed by ever having read a book or knowing anything about it, right? And so there's something about that, which is a kind of superficial sense of grievance in both instances, and a claiming on grievance for this reason or that. So I just wondered how much the foreign policy thing is an issue. And Rania, I think your point was very interesting about what's actually happening in the area, and you're so vain. I think that's absolutely a fair point, except there's also lots of panels that are not about... This is actually a panel, in a way, about the West. What's happening here? I actually think we do have to think, why is it that young British people turn their back on British values? Young Western people, that's what I think this panel's about. That's all I was going to say. Whatever else, I think that is what I don't even myself understand. That's what I'm simply saying. Anyway, who wants to make something up? Motion, and then...
Yeah, I had Sadia Azmat, a comedian who's researching for a programme, and she came and checked, you know, she said, how difficult is it? What do you think about it? And we started talking about this idea about how could the media... Really represent these people for what they truly are. And they're a bunch of frustrated idiots, to be honest with you. And I said, well, imagine, what would it look like if you had a sketch where, for example, a preacher would come out of the mosque, you know, after preaching, and would get into his limo with a couple of white escorts. Now, the public would think, oh, that's a bit close to the bone. But in reality, there's a lot... I mean, I studied in France, and... The socioeconomic group that's left France to go there, they come from the suburbs, and they've not had any sense of identity. They don't feel that they belong, so they're thinking, well, let's just go. They've all had a lot of time spent in prison, and it is really about the media getting the narrative right and representing these people for what they truly are, which is just criminals. And if we insist on representing them as having some form of legitimate claim to have even a state, I think that gives them a bit too much importance that they don't really deserve. Okay. So I think it's a very good point.
Bill? Whilst I agree with a lot of what Mohsen has got to say, and obviously I appreciate it's hard being at the, you know, front line in many ways of all of this, I do think there's a limit to how much you can push that argument that you're just a bunch of criminals or frustrated idiots, or indeed we've heard other suggestions of mental ill health. And, you know, it's a bit like me trying to tell my children there's no value in being a rapper, in fact, you know, because, you know, that doesn't make you great, and they just look at me and say, yeah, but they make a lot of money, they have a good time. You know, they play the emotional card. And the reason it doesn't work is you're trying to counterpose a kind of political or principled argument against a kind of a moral position or an emotional position. And what it really draws out is that we're confused as to our own morality. And actually, I think the starting point would be to clarify our own moral values and provide leadership in that regard, and not in the way that I think the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary think they're going to do it, which is just by telling us what those values are, because real values are the values we live every day. They're not just the values that are printed up for us. They're how we live our lives, and the lived reality of our values is that we are quite conflicted in that regard. And I think I just add a point on the identity politics and multiculturalism stuff that was drawn out from the audience, because I think it's very important to realise that this race to the bottom of identity, and my identity is more victimised and has been more hurt than your identity, is in a way a consequence of the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the political left and the political right. People no longer have collective projects that they belong to in the same way as they would have had a generation ago. And now they're clinging on to, you know, the little that they have left, which is who they are. The point was made about tolerance. I don't think we live in a tolerant society. I think we live in an indifferent society where we turn a blind eye to what other people get up to, and we say, well, I will tolerate that by not looking. That's very different. And actually, we're intolerant because someone calls themselves an eco-terrorist, they get hauled up. You know, a child, you know, calls another child, you know, a bad name in the playground, they get accused of being racist or homophobic. They're children. We're highly intolerant and at the same time indifferent. Real tolerance requires robustly engaging with the people you disagree with.
Okay, thanks. Ted.
The colleague up there reminded us that this is not just a British problem. Across Europe, we're seeing the rise of the far right, largely on the basis of an anti-Islamification agenda. Pegida in Germany that have grown, but virtually every other European country has got the far right actually in power in shared circumstances, even in Scandinavia. And I think we've got to ask ourselves what we're doing right as well as what we're doing wrong, because you can go to a lot of young people in schools which are very diverse, where young people actually enjoy the diversity, see it as something which is something that they can engage with. There are two things going on here. There is, you know, the the problem of a simple single identity, and there is the problem of and the benefit of a multiple identity. I'm very much a critic of old style multiculturalism. I've written books about interculturalism and hope that that gains strength. But it is this question of shared identity which I think is really crucial in that. When Sheikh Ibrahim Moghra was interviewed in a TV interview, the presenter kept pushing him, saying, answer this question as a Muslim. And he said, well, yeah, I am a Muslim, but I'm a person first. And this idea somehow that you can have more than one identity as a human, as well as various other identities, is part of the narrative that we're missing. I think, you know, Bill made that point very strongly, that there isn't an alternative narrative which actually says there doesn't have to be a them and us type of identity. It's not a zero-sum game. That you can actually share different identities at different times, and that you will gain different identities and develop different identities over time. So I think there's a real philosophical problem about how we address identity, not just in the UK, but across Europe. And this notion that we have British values, if you look at the British values, they're pretty much universal values, actually. There's nothing particularly British about them, but we constantly want to try and create a separate identity for our own tribal group.
Just yesterday in the discussion on artistic freedom again, Nadia, who's the director of the play Homegrown, that none of you will have seen because it was censored, the one that was about the radicalisation of young people, NYT pulled it. Anyway, Nadia was making the point, when she was writing her articles, she said it was bad enough that was going on, but then in particular the media, but in particular The Guardian, kept wanting to describe me as a Muslim play director. I said, you know, I'm an atheist. I was brought up in a Muslim, but they kept saying, no, but it's better if we describe you as a Muslim playwright. Better for what, who, where? More of the victim card, but that's, I think, some of the traps of multiculturalism that we're talking about. Anyway.
No, I agree with that. It's interesting about, the thing with multiculturalism is when people choose themselves, whatever, whether they want to be atheist or Muslim or be called feminist or just, I don't know, a housewife or whatever it is. It's their choice. It's when it's been imposed. And when you have policy that actually then kind of puts outlines where you have to sit within that box. And when money comes to actually support that policy, and I think that's when the divisions start actually growing and being entrenched. And we know that happened in many areas. In terms of what's currently happening, it's a bit like, you know, I don't know, Ford saying you can have any color as long as black. You can be a Muslim as long as. And someone else seems to be setting the agenda of what it is like to be Muslim, as opposed to be discussing with people who profess a variety of views of Islam. And it's the question about reformation. It has been going on for a long time, maybe not reformation in the way at a particular point in time, but there have been many scholars across Islamic history who have had a far more interpretive view of Islam. And one of the current writers in America is Reza Aslan, who's been writing about religion generally and Islam in particular. And there were others, Muhammad Abdul in the early 20th century in Egypt and others. Part of the problem, back to the Western and why it's important for us, is that the strand that, beside the fact that the origins of ISIS and would be the Iraq invasion and the mess there, that's another story, but the strand of Islam, the Wahhabism, which has come, and the Salafis that Shiraz has mentioned and studied, that's come out of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is one of our major allies here in Britain. And we have supported and turned a blind eye to the fact that that brand has actually been, Saudi Arabia has paid a lot of money training a lot of so-called imams and funding a lot of mosques that will only have that perspective. But also within the region, what we have is one of our allies, supported by us, actually fomenting the visions and the creation of groups. So yes, I know that it is important to discuss what's happening here, but we can't take it away and link it, because the fact that the whole of ISIS exists is actually quite complex. It's regional, it's international, and it does link to ideas of belonging and not belonging, but I come back to the numbers.
Okay, right.
It's not that big.
Everyone's talking about identity in this context. I think it's already been said, but it's worth saying again, is this idea that when the state engages in these debates, it tends to look at Muslims principally as Muslims. It doesn't engage them as citizens, or it doesn't seek to call upon any of the other multifaceted parts of their identity. So it comes to you as a Muslim. Therefore, if I want to engage the state, it's going to be easiest for me to do it as a Muslim. That means when I engage politically, my confessional identity has to take prominence and precedent. And then in that context, should it be surprising that people turn to Islamist politics in order to give themselves expression politically? So the government needs to be smart about how it engages with people in that sense. And it needs to see Muslims as more than just being Muslim. There's also been the discussion about British values and what are British values, or indeed are these universal values. I think actually I've been a big proponent of this debate, saying we need to inflect British values into the discussion more. We overcomplicate this. It just comes down to basic issues of tolerance. And if you build that into the debate, no one can A, argue against it, but B, people can appreciate what you mean when you talk about having a tolerant society and allowing people to live the lives that they want to live, creating a neutral space in the public arena so that people can be who they want to be. And Britain provides that better than most other places. So that allows you to have a conservative Salafi mosque at one end of a street and a Sufi mosque at the other end of that same street. When the Luton family, from the grandfather down to the infant child, three generations, got up and went to Syria, they issued a press release. And they said that one of the things that they had wanted to do was to leave Britain because David Cameron was washing away Islam. That's a very easy thing to rebut. Because when you look at who's really washing away Islam, it's Islamic State, who wash away any expression of Shia Islam, who wash away Sufi Islam, who wash away any form of Islam that doesn't conform to their incredibly narrow definition of it. So I think ultimately we need to be far more robust about talking about the tolerance in our society.
Okay, right. Lots of hands, all going to make quick points, and we're going to take as many as possible.
Yeah, thank you very much. Excellent critique. I really enjoyed all of what you had to say. I was particularly struck by the criticism of cultural relativism that was made by, I think, Bill. And I wondered if you could specify the content that you think should shape our curriculum, for example, which kind of thinkers, so on and so forth, that should be driving or filling that void. Otherwise, there's a real danger that I think you're going to collapse into becoming part of the very problem that you seek to critique. All I've heard is talk about values. Now, values can be virtuous or vicious depending on viewpoint, and that's subjective. I've heard about critical thinking, which is just the process of thinking. I want to know more about what is the content of this curriculum that can challenge these ideas.
So there's been a common thread and theme of challenging and debunking and debating with young people. As an educator, as a teacher, there are strategies such as Prevent that actually have us shackled and don't enable us to have this open forum with the students to debunk and challenge their ideas and to allow them to actually speak openly and freely. So how are we supposed to overcome that if, you know, just them speaking, even the mention of eco-terrorism, just the word terrorism, has us reporting them to Prevent?
All right. So my personal experience with talking to some people here in The Hague, in the Netherlands, in a neighborhood where a lot of radicalization is happening, is that it's actually not perhaps a battle of ideas, that there's not an ideology on the other side drawing people out of the British values, of the Dutch values, of the Western values, but that's not ideological at all, that is not even Western values driving them away, but that it's actual daily life experiences that are where we are rejecting them to have any hope for a better future. Youth unemployment, especially under men, was over 80% in this region. People had no chances for a job, no chance for an income, which meant no chance for finding a spouse or starting a family, which meant that basically any idea of leading a good life here was made impossible for them. And in factually true, like there's no myth there, that's actually the case. So then I would say if that then is an important element, if this group is treated so differently by in our society, then we have to treat them differently in policy as well. So I would suggest providing jobs, like literally creating jobs specifically and only for this group that's a threat, so we can provide them hope for a better future here.
Surely we want a morally constituted and public engaged society anyway, I mean kind of irrelevant of ISIS. So I guess the kind of question I'd like to pin our panel on a little bit is what you think of what we should do with British citizens who have fought for ISIS and would like to come back. Is it an assertion of British values to say, well, you know, let you back in and lock you up for the rest of your life? Or is it an assertion of British values to not indulge, to hold, you know, the people who have gone to account and say, well, actually, you know, you've gone against the fundamentals of what it is to be a British citizen, and that we should then revoke your citizenship. Are we as a panel comfortable with that kind of assertion of British values? Because it's a conundrum I struggle with, and I'd like to hear your thoughts.
I was interested in the point that the gentleman was making about when you go on the media, you have to be identified as a Muslim in order to kind of speak. And so it's that kind of identity that is given prominence over your humanity, I suppose. And I've got a question about what happens in schools now, I think, with multiculturalism. Because what I notice, for example, is when it's Ramadan, my daughter's school, it's almost a kind of imposed thing, it feels like to me, that you even the children are Muslims first and children at school second. So I've got absolutely nothing against the kids practicing Ramadan or anything like that, but it's almost I feel like if you're a Muslim who didn't want to practice that, you'd be kind of left out of the gang in a way, and it's become that is the first thing that you have to be, and then anything else is second, and that comes from a very young age now, I think, in this kind of defensive society that we live in.
So I think Professor Darodi is obviously right to say that if we don't believe in our values like democracy and we're prepared to stand up for them when educating them, then why should we expect these young kids to? But I think I disagree with you being so dismissive of the points about criminality and this aspect of it that other people on the panel have raised. And the reason I say that is because I think there is another value which you seem to be kind of glossing over, which is personal responsibility, which is autonomy, which is the fact that people are able to choose their own direction and within the context, you know, unemployment, all these kinds of issues. But at the end of the day, we want to hold people to account. And there's a danger in the way you're going at it, which is that we say these people are kind of blameless, that it's the rest of society that somehow not given them anything to believe in, when actually we're all part of this process. And the transition to adulthood is about kind of working out which way you're going to go, whether you're going to sell drugs, join ISIS, have a family, and all the rest of it. So I think we've got to make sure that element is in there. It's an important value that we have to retain, and that as much as democracy and any of these other values.
Somebody said at the beginning that this was about moral abdication of what we truly believe in. So I know what I believe in, and I'm passionate about all sorts of aspects of Western civilization. I can't do a rap song about it. But I just wondered, would the panel members mind sharing with us what aspects of Western life they might be passionate about?
Okay, so I was just wondering, what do you think the difference is between approaching and confronting the issues as a Muslim versus as a non-Muslim? So, do you think that non-Muslims refusing to indulge and possibly being insensitive could further alienate the Muslim community and like feed this identity of victimhood. And what do you think the difference should be between approaching it from within the community versus from outside?
I really liked Mr. Oja's point that the people who are going out to join ISIS are essentially criminal. What I'd say is, you know, maybe these people are essentially the infantry, the foot soldiers in this. And actually, if you've ever met the infantry, certainly in the UK, you know, they're not the brightest people. They do occasionally get into fights and into problems with the law. And I agree with you.
Some of the squaddies in the back are getting...
Sorry, okay. You can take me out later. But that doesn't... To me, that doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't an ideology that's driving this and that there isn't a sort of a bigger problem here to address. I really don't believe that Islam is problematic. Personally, I do believe that there are problematic and very superficial interpretations of Islam. And I wonder whether the panellists agree with this and have any further thoughts.
I was interested in the discussion on identity because it seems that it was focused on there being a fixed identity that we would then communicate to the Muslim community and ask them to buy into. And surely an identity is a process where you also learn off of other communities. And I was also interested in the point that our own culture, our own ruling elite, have very shallow, hypocritical views of identity and are very confused themselves. And we have a prevent strategy which is based on that, which is looking at right-wing extremism and the... which is, to me, a form of tokenism, simply to deflect from the fact that it's targeted at Muslims. In essence, I question whether a state that has no values at its core can communicate anything through a prevent strategy. And perhaps the prevent strategy should have started by them actually considering what their identity was, how they could learn from other communities, and having a debate about that before they actually set out to prevent radicalisation, as they call it, which is in itself a very Western way of viewing things.
With regard to the moral abrogation of responsibility and the fact that a Muslim head of a largely Muslim school can tell the parents what he's going to do, I joined UKIP partly because I am confused about what are the rights, duties, responsibilities, permissions can be given to the majority culture over and above the minorities that are with them. I don't know what they are, want someone to tell me.
There's no difference when I speak at the Islamic Society meetings than when I'm speaking at a feminist society meetings on campus. There's no difference because they all hate me. They're all very easily offended. Everyone's got a huge sense of grievance and thin skin is rampant, right? And so it's basically everyone sitting there saying, you can't say that, you can't say that. I can't believe you've said that. Lots of tears, lots of recriminations, a generational sense of a combination of entitlement, identity politics and a toxic mix with victim politics. That's what's really confusing because it does seem that that's almost like the driver more than anything else. But obviously... And there's certainly a new form of youthful narcissism is not new. We've all been there. But there does seem to be a particularly self-obsessed generation with looking for things to believe in. That is true. The ISIS fits a narrative in particular, works as a narrative in some instances. There are other very destructive behaviours that I think that we see young people being attracted to as well. Self-harming, suicide. I mean, actually, people actually aspiring to that. Gangs, people have mentioned. So is it different, I suppose? Now, you can't answer that in the end, but that's what I still am trying to toy with. I do think that if we haven't got the confidence, by the way, as adults, to say to young people, you're being narcissistic and talking rubbish from time to time, that we're not doing them any favours. I think that what we have to do is to actually say, no, you're wrong, that is rubbish, read this book. If you want the book list, see me later. Right. OK, in reverse order...
Some observations on some of the comments that were made. And hearing more about, you know, British values and Muslims, I'm kind of uncomfortable because the radicals are not the only ones who turn their back on British values. Every criminal is against British values.
And if we keep saying, you know, these people are turning their back, which, yeah, they might do, but they do it on the back of not following and not adhering to agreed rules and regulations. And in the, again, there's this perception, and there's always a risk of alienating more and more Muslims because there's this kind of implicit relationship between lack of, you know, lack of alignment with British values and Islam. And I think for young people who are vulnerable, there is that causes a risk. The point about schools and Ramadan, I think, is going back to the point that I was making. It's very difficult to understand what it means to be Muslim. I mean, your point, you said that I'm a Muslim principal, but I'm Sunni. There are many other trends of Islam that I wouldn't be able to understand. So we need to be very careful not to amalgamate all Muslims, because there's varied levels of Islam and varied differences as there are in other religions. So I think we need to embrace and be more understanding and be more willing to understand what Islam is about and not say Muslim is this. Because that matters a lot to young people. It will help them to identify. And it will make them aware and will make them know that people are interested. You know, society is interested, the state is interested. So if you have a problem with that, by all means, speak to the head. And heads need to know what they can and can't do. The point about the prayer room, I threatened students to close it because they weren't using it sensibly. And my point is, the entitlement is they can use the multi-faith prayer room. It's not just a prayer room for Muslims at break and lunchtime because it doesn't have any impact on their learning. And it was okay. When you tell them what to do, generally they do it. And the last point about prevent, you're absolutely right. It feels that this policy that the government has done, like many others, I have to say, in education, is that it's something that they're making along as they're implementing. Yes, there is this need to prevent and to safeguard young people, but they haven't given teachers the right training. They haven't really given the schools and local authorities the right links to liaise. And we have some highly skilled prevent officers, but they're finding it very, very difficult. And I think it's just about giving the policy some time to embed, because I think it has some value in safeguarding young people who are at significant risk. So I think those are my closing remarks.
I'm surprised there is no prayer room. I'm horrified, Claire. Next time I won't take a photo. Just a joke. The idea, the question that stayed, two questions stayed with me. I agree about prevent. When I think about my student with the hipster beard and whether he's a radical, and I thought to myself, what might radicalize him? I thought, well, maybe because he's paying £9,000 a year to get less than 8 hours of tuition for a qualification that will hardly get him a job. Maybe that would radicalize me. So we are complicit, not in terms of, you know, again, what do we mean by radicalization? That's another story. Yes, going off to fight or to kill people, but how do we get there? Again, the question about the question that I liked was about the Western values. What do we like about Western values? I don't think once I arrive in the airport in London, sometimes Westernism starts. What I noticed, I was in Belgium recently, in Brussels. Invited to speak at the European Parliament, and I wanted to get a train from Brussels to Bruges, and the Brussels station was horrible. It was chaotic. I couldn't get any advice, and actually it made me realise how lucky we are in Britain to have a really good rail system. Very different here, and it's really funny. It's sometimes, you know, having multiple identities. When I'm abroad, I feel more English or British or whatever it is. When I'm here, I feel more Lebanese sometimes. It is that fluidity. So I don't think Western values are within a geographic sense. I think there are universal values. Maybe what we need to be discussing is those universal values we can all adhere to, we can all promote, and we can all actually fight for. And this is the thing I think we really need to be talking about. And connected to this, who would be those values? I think when we talk about critical thinking, it's about questioning, but questioning with knowledge. And I say that to my students because, you know, universities say to students, we listen to your voice. We're really interested in what you have to say. And I say to them, I don't want to hear what you have to say. You know nothing yet. Start learning, start getting knowledge, start actually developing your thinking, and then maybe we can have a conversation.
Thanks. Yeah.
I'll start with this gentleman's question. Is it an interpretation of Islam in terms of what ISIS is doing? Yes. You know, it's deeply unhelpful when politicians say it's neither Islamic nor is it a state. It's both in reality. Everything Islamic State does, all of the violence, all of the behaviours that it is going through are not whimsical. They are based on a reading and interpretation of theology, however esoteric it is, however contested it may be within normative Islam, the reality remains it has constructed a theology that is grounded within the sources of Islam itself. So that is the fight that Muslims need to have. And I find, actually again, when I'm in the Arab world or the Muslim world, that there's a better understanding that yes, this is coming from something within our own traditions, we need to challenge it, rather than the discussion that takes place in Western societies, which sort of seems to deny that and say this is some kind of aberration. It's not. You know, even to give you an example, the burning of the Jordanian pilot, there is a deeply contested theology around it, but it does have a basis in scripture. So this is a construction of Islam. Someone else asked about returnees. I think it's the second time someone asked about it, so I'll talk about that very briefly. We need to have a policy that is pragmatic and a policy that is smart with regards to returnees. And those are two things that it seems to me Theresa May is absolutely trying her hardest not to do. So what do I mean by this? Look, some of the people who go off and join ISIS do so when they're 15 years old, 16 years old. These are people who we need to try and disengage from that organization. People are going for all kinds of different reasons. So you need to understand who is there and what it is that motivated them, what crimes they've committed whilst they're in that organization, and how you begin to pull them out. The sheer scale of mobilization in support of Islamic State, the sheer number of people who have gone there is so unprecedented that you can't firstly expect to kill them all, or secondly, realistically manage down the terrorism threat that faces the West without some policy which will ultimately have to engage them. And I just give you this one example. Look what happened in Afghanistan in the 1980s. We didn't disengage the so-called Arab Mujahideen who went there. They spent the 1990s trying to work out a new path for themselves, and you found what they did. The next very serious plot against the West, against our society, is going to emerge from Syria. So we need a policy that is, as I say, it's pragmatic and it's smart and it reacts to the individuals as they present themselves.
I'll address the Scandinavian friend who points out that certain groups of people in society are treated differently or are, unequal structurally. And that's true, but the solution to that is precisely not to do what you advocate. So you advocate that we go out of our way to, you know, treat them differently. In other words, you end up by formalizing inequality in society. You're basically saying people are different, they are unequal, therefore I will treat them unequally, whereas the solution is actually to fight for equality and to overcome the structural barriers. Easier said than done, but nevertheless, that's the problem with that approach, in my opinion. There was a woman at the front asked about, what's the difference between how Muslims and non-Muslims think about these things. Really, I just think you need to overcome that kind of thinking. When I was young, was very interested in politics precisely because it took me outside of my own personal lived experience. It made me fight for black people's rights and other people who really were not part of what I had experienced. And I think the danger of thinking along the lines of what does a Muslim think, what does a non-Muslim think, is you fetishize experience and you end up trapping people within it. I'm concerned about training. Training is the solution to everything, we're told. But I mean, it begs the question, of course, and I'm sure you know this, who does the training? How competent are they? You've seen a panel of, pretty, serious people, trying to get their heads around this. You're going to get second-rate local government officers doing, tick box sheet training, which is going to be catastrophic. How do we stop prevent? I think, as it happens, take some lessons from our headmaster here. Talk to the community that you work with, engage them, and then organise as a collective. The government is concerned that radicalisation appears suddenly, and it's far from being sudden. It's precisely because they're not actually understanding what's going on. It's a gradual process, and Ted will talk more about this, you know, because people live parallel lives with mythical histories that are rarely interrogated. Our leaders are divorced from these communities. It's high time they tried to reconnect with them. And very final point to Shiraz, I'm all in favour of de-radicalising people, but it always begs the question, to what? And that's the starting point for me. You know, what is it that we stand for? Otherwise, we can't, you know, when they come back, de-radicalise them to something because we don't know what it is that we want them to become in the first place.
Well, we have homogenised Muslim communities in the UK. And we failed to recognise that actually there's a huge range of difference within those communities. But more than that, we've created a victim culture amongst Muslim communities and given the Muslim identity a sense of agency and power. That's why, Claire, they demand the prayer room, because we're saying to them, as a Muslim, you have power, you have agency, and failing to recognise that that is what will drive their sense of themselves as well as our sense of them. And there are, of course, other victims, there are other victim cultures which we've created, but for the purpose of this discussion, we're more focused on the Muslim communities. How do we begin to make the change? Somebody made the point earlier on about, well, what do you do in schools? For goodness sake, it's easy. You start every day in a school talking about contentious issues. You get the newspapers out. You have a discussion about what's going on in the world around you. You begin to give young people a chance to actually have those open debates about what they believe, about what we believe, about what society believes. And do not address this as a sense of fixed values. The idea that somehow we've got this UK sense of British values or even European values is ridiculous. They are constantly changing and evolving. When I think about the values that, you know, I grew up with years ago, would be totally different to the sorts of values that we're talking about today. But we don't engage in those debates. We don't actually allow people to develop that sense in which they believe in something for themselves. So I think this is actually not as difficult as it seems to be. And there are schools, as I alluded to earlier, there are societies, there are groups where people don't live in parallel lives. They live actually in communities where people are engaged and are actually very much empowered by that sense in which they belong in a diverse, multicultural society which works for them.
Coming now, clap, all of our speakers.